Hey, health junkies. It's time for The Health Fix. Join your host, Dr. Janine Krause, as she gives you a dose of what you need to know and do right now to take control of your health from the inside out, to rebel against aging, look damn good, fight stress, and laugh every day.
Hello there, health junkies. Welcome to another episode of The Health Fix. I'm your host, Dr. Janine Krause. In today's episode, we are going to be talking about eating disorders and really shedding some light on some of the stigma that's out there and the reality of what's happening with these fad diets out there and what's happening to folks. And I have brought on Stacy Schulter-Pisano. She is a therapist and a site director at the Emily program, which we are lucky to have here in Washington. But don't worry, for those of you that are out of state, you might be in one of the lucky states where they do have the program. But we'll get you set up with all of the different resources you can have later on in the podcast to be able to get yourself the help you need. Now, Stacy is a marriage and family health counselor. She is also a certified eating disorder specialist, and she's been in the game for 11 years, just like me. So there you have it. You are loaded with lots of expertise today. Say hello, Stacy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. Oh my goodness. I'm so excited to talk about this because, folks, stay tuned. You're going to hear some good stuff today. It's one of the big things in my practice, and this is, I had Stacy in my office not too long ago because I was wanting to talk about eating disorders just in general and how to manage them, because a lot of practitioners like myself are not trained really well in terms of identifying an eating disorder and really knowing what to do about it. And then add these fad diets and restrictive diets that are helping people with their pain and other issues, but at the same time, could we be causing an eating disorder? And so today we're going to kind of talk around all of that stuff. But first and foremost, I would love to have Stacy tell us a little bit about the Emily program and tell us a little bit about how you got into this game.
Absolutely. Thank you. So the Emily program is a treatment center for eating disorders. We offer treatment at various levels of care. So we start at the outpatient level of care, meaning a person meets with a therapist and or a dietitian once a week, and we're addressing things in that way. We also have intensive outpatient, which is up to 12 hours a week. We have partial hospitalization up to 35 hours a week, and we have residential treatment as well. And along with all of those things, we offer comprehensive, really approachable assessments for individuals that want to pursue some understanding of their relationship with food, or talk a little bit more, or investigate a little bit more into whether or not there's a problem that's present, or their relationship with food has gotten a little bit out of balance. I love the work we do, and I've been with the Emily program for 4 years now, since we opened our site in Lacey, Washington. And as far as how I got into the work, I struggled with my own eating disorder 18 years ago, and it was pretty critical concern, and there wasn't a lot of treatment available at that time. I lived in Washington State, and at that time, there were limited treatment centers in my town. There were limited providers working with eating disorders. So I and my parents both had a really hard time accessing services and getting the support that was necessary. And from that experience, I realized that it was something that I could and wanted to do, was help people that struggle in their relationship with food or with body image, support the families that are trying to raise a child that's dealing with some challenges with food. And I just got really excited about the prospect of helping. And then I got my master's in psychology, which was just fascinating and fantastic for me, and started doing some work with eating disorders, both in private practice. And then when the Emily program asked me if I wanted to work with them, I was thrilled to be doing something that was much more comprehensive and provided more services.
Yeah, the services that you guys provide are incredible. And folks, if you're listening to the podcast right now and you're thinking, ooh, I need to check this out, we will get into more detail in terms of the different programs. And of course, you could head over to their website as well, and we'll talk all about that in a little bit
later. I think first where we want to go with this podcast, at least where I want to go, because it's my biggest, you know, concern that as individuals, we have this stigma around an eating disorder. And I think a lot of people pass off eating disorders as being only the issue of folks who are very, very thin or folks who are overweight and extremely overweight. I think some of us who are somewhere in the middle, you know, go undetected by doctors in particular. And if we don't say the right things, then the radar doesn't go up and on the practitioner who's listening. And so tell me a little bit about what you see in terms of stigma around eating disorders, Stacey.
Oh, absolutely. So I think as far as stigma and as far as the different beliefs about eating disorders, there are so many. But in particular, what I run into are individuals that believe that people affected by eating disorders are predominantly young, female, Caucasian individuals. And furthermore, people indicate that people with eating disorders must be either, you know, on the very small side or on the very thin side, or if somebody's in a larger body, there's some assumptions that go into that as well. And part of the work that I do and part of what I feel really inspired to do is help people understand that eating disorders do not discriminate. Eating disorders can affect people of all different ages, all different socioeconomic statuses, all different cultural backgrounds, anybody on the gender spectrum. We really cannot make assumptions about people based on their presentation or, you know, their lived experience or the individual they are or their body size, because we never know what's actually happening for an individual as far as their relationship with food is concerned. And many of the stereotypes about the people that struggle with eating disorders are untrue and are myths in general. In particular, a couple of things that you said brought to mind. You know, one of the fastest growing populations of people that struggle with eating disorders are middle age. What we also know is that there is a high percentage of individuals in the LGBTQ community that struggle with disordered eating. A recent study that I read indicated as many as 50% of individuals struggling or living in the LGBTQ community are experiencing challenges in their relationship with food or really intrusive body image concerns. And along with those things, what we also know is that less than 50% of people who are meeting full criteria for an eating disorder are asked about those things by the health professional that they see.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, being a health practitioner myself, you know, it didn't really occur to me, which is sad. It really didn't occur to me how common this is, and actually really didn't occur to me that I might even have an issue until it was brought to my attention during an annual visit of my own. Because I think a lot of times when we think about eating disorders, we might be thinking about, I think a lot of times we kind of pass it off as almost a joke. We're like, oh, I binge ate on my, you know, favorite pretzels, or, oh, I stress ate this, I stress ate that. And we just kind of blow it off. But these could be signs of huge issues.
Absolutely, yes. And I think there is a tendency to minimize whatever symptom use somebody might be using. So whether that be, you know, binge eating, like you mentioned, you know, I've talked to people that experience binge eating and, you know, they've asked me outside of my office, you know, do you think this is a problem? And I'm like, well, you know, are you experiencing, you know, binge eating 1 to 2 times a week, for example? Do you feel out of control while you're engaging in the behavior? How do you feel after? You know, and frequently what I'm hearing is, oh yes, I feel out of control. I feel very ashamed after, and I don't understand why I don't have more quote unquote willpower. And the reality is, once we're actively struggling with an eating disorder, such as binge eating disorder, it's, you know, to recover from something like that, to overcome that, takes so much more than willpower. And, you know, we really do recommend that somebody be involved in treatment or getting necessary support instead of using some of the methods that they might try, which would be dieting or restricting their intake a little bit more. excuse me. And so with regards to that behavior, I think that's relevant. And then furthermore, in our culture, which is very diet-centric, we are talking a lot about dieting and people going on new and different diets, eliminating different food groups, you know, and some of those very same behaviors can be part of the picture of a critical eating disorder or of an eating disorder that meets full criteria for a diagnosis.
Oh my goodness. I mean, you've hit on so many points there that I think it's almost like having conversations with your friends, really honing in, like, what would you say? I was thinking about it while you were talking, like, what would I say to a friend who was like, you know, the willpower thing? I mean, and even just patients, because I don't know how many patients come into my office and they're like, I just can't, I have no willpower anymore. I've lost my ability to control what I eat, when I eat, and I keep, you know, I'm trying to find the right diet I need to be on. And I cringe every time I hear that, you know, and I always go back to, okay, we really need to go back to basics. But I feel like sometimes it's wasted trying to go back to basics when we haven't conquered the actual problem of the eating disorder, and could very well be why so many people fail on diets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Well, and diets in general, you know, so, and to your point that people fail on diets, you know, the reality is that people do not fail diets. Diets fail.
Yes.
In fact, 95% of diets fail. And that is partially, you know, there's a host of reasons why that is. But one of the predominant ones is, you know, our biological makeup is not designed to be restricted from food. You know, when we go on a diet, we are putting ourselves into a famine state of type. And our kind of cave person brain responds by demanding more nutrition, by demanding more food. And so we're going against biology when we're trying to restrict our intake below, you know, an amount that our body actually needs.
And I'm glad you corrected me on that, because yes, it is true. It is not the person that fails. I hate that word. I hate the word diet just in general. But it's true. It's really that the diet. Now let's talk a little bit about diets for all intents and purposes, even though I hate the word. There are so many fad diets out there, if you will. And I call them fad diets because paleo, yes, it's been around a while, but the cabbage soup diet still exists somewhere out there and the hard boiled egg diet and the, I mean, you name it, but autoimmune paleo, keto, all of these diets, these are, you know, gluten-free, dairy-free, et cetera. I will see people, I get everyone, you know, from the spectrum that comes in either on a particular diet plan or following a specific way to eat. And we have basically a lot of folks who are like, I feel really good with this diet, but yet I'm finding myself having intense cravings for certain foods, like keto diet and things of that nature. How often do you guys have folks coming in that really start on one of these restrictive diets and it turns into an eating disorder? Or how often do you hear about folks who have eating disorders pre-existing and then they get on one of these diets and things worsen?
So frequently. I can't even tell you how frequently, but I think what we want to know is that approximately 1 in 4 people who go on a diet will develop a full-blown clinical eating disorder, which is pretty high numbers, you know, 25% of people who go on a diet. And when we consider that, you know, 80% of 10-year-olds are on a diet in our culture, you know, there are some really pre-existing factors that are making people more likely to develop some disordered eating tendencies. So I would say so frequently when I'm talking with people, you know, we're looking at their relationship with food and whether it go back to, I went on my first diet when I was 10 and I've been on one ever since, or, you know, I went on a diet in my early 20s, for health reasons. And we oftentimes want to know about the motivation. What was the motivation behind that? Because the diet industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, makes so many promises about what this diet will do for you. It's for health reasons. You'll lose weight. You'll have more energy. You'll sleep better. You know, lots of different promises made by the various different diets that are out there. You know, and we want to know what the motivation was for people. And then oftentimes it can, depending on the person's genetic makeup and their brain structure and function, it can activate an eating disorder for the individual that is vulnerable to dealing with those things. And whether that eating disorder be one that is more restrictive in nature and it becomes more rigid and rule bound as they start to adopt a diet, or like you said, you know, somebody that has eliminated foods and now they're dealing with cravings. And as soon as they introduce that food to their body, they feel like they can't stop and they're overdoing it. Or they're saying, well, this is the only time I'm going to let myself have this. So I may as well go to town while I'm doing it, or whatever it is. So I think we can have a host of different behaviors that are activated by dieting itself.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you've made so many different points just now in talking that, where I'm going, oh my God, what have I done to my patients? What have I done? And what have I done to myself? And here, I mean, I've been off and on and off a diet since I was 10. I watched my mom do the yo-yo diet thing my whole childhood. And I learned, you know, I learned from the best. Wow, you know, her and my mom and her sister or other cousins would sit around the table at holiday parties and literally talk about, you know, how they were binging for the holiday. And then, you know, tomorrow they weren't going to eat anything at all. And, you know, I think about this and I think about all the things I heard growing up and I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's terrible. And I also think about even, yes, the fad diets, but I'm also thinking about all of this food sensitivity testing. Are we doing a disservice by testing food sensitivities?
I think that's a good question. I think there are, you know, medical reasons to evaluate whether or not somebody does have a food sensitivity or has a reaction to particular foods. We certainly want to know if somebody has an intolerance to something, an allergy to something. I think where we start to branch out a little bit away from the four medical reasons is when we're looking at, you know, bloating, for example. Well, when I eat sugar, my stomach gets bloated. Well, you know, bloating is something that naturally happens after all of us eat. So are we getting too sensitive about some things and then encouraging somebody to avoid eating whatever that substance is? You know, I think finding out if somebody is intolerant or what reaction somebody has when they introduce a particular food is really relevant for medical reasons, certainly. You know, or if we do know that it activates particular things within their overall system, we certainly want to be aware of that. And then where it comes in as the practitioner is the monitoring over time. You know, if you do have somebody that has a gluten sensitivity, for example, you know, if we are going to be eliminating gluten, what we want to make sure is that that individual is still able to meet their nutritional needs with alternative foods and, you know, get in that wide variety that they need without getting too excessively rigid about not having gluten. They may rule out gluten, but they still have to be aware of feeding their body appropriately in all other domains.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which also leads me to thinking a lot about going back to the fad diets with the paleo or the autoimmune paleo, for example. I think a lot of people will tell me, I feel really great on these diets. And it's usually within the first couple months. After that, then they're going, I am annoyed by the diet. I can't do this. I can't do that. And I almost wonder if there's somewhat of a placebo effect in terms of the control. Like you're able to control a little bit. You've gained a little control over your eating by doing the Whole 30 or by doing paleo. And then it just seems to kind of go off the rails for a little bit.
Right, right. And I think it does depend very much on the person, you know, so if in that statistic that I cited, you know, one in four people who goes on a diet will, you know, develop a full-blown eating disorder. That's three in four people that, you know, can diet, you know, and change their dietary intake or change their eating lifestyle. But like you said, I think after a few months, people do get a little tired of it or annoyed by it, because what we're talking about is change of eating pattern for a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so there does have to be, you know, significant reasoning behind what the change and behind the why. You know, if somebody does have an autoimmune condition, and for that reason, it's recommended that they avoid gluten or they reduce gluten or not have it altogether, you know, having them really understand what does happen when they introduce that substance is important, so that it really is for medical reason. You know, cutting out gluten, I think, is different than cutting out all carbohydrates. You know, mm-hmm. if somebody's cutting out all carbohydrates, well, likely their body is going to prompt them to have carbohydrates. They are going to experience cravings because they're missing a pretty important fuel-giving macronutrient. And so they are going to experience some, you know, desire for that food. And we're surrounded by the option for carbohydrates. Taking out gluten is taking out one form, you know, of food that is in some carbohydrates, but not all. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, let's talk about taking out the carbohydrates for a minute. And I'll talk about a little bit of my personal experience here. And folks, this is where I really want to share a little bit of my own personal story. On the Emily Program's website, which is emilyprogram.com, right? Am I saying it right?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. emilyprogram.com. You can take a quiz, and you can take it for yourself. You can take a quiz as a family member. You can take a quiz as a practitioner. It's kind of cool. There's a lot of different options for quizzes there to assess whoever you're concerned about. But if it's yourself, there's 6 questions, and I went through the questions, and I answered yes to 5 of the 6, which sat me back a little bit to be like, oh my gosh, okay. I have lost control over my eating. And I've talked on the podcast before. I have a whole podcast about why do I stress eat and why do I overeat. And it goes back to, yes, I watched my family, you know, my mother in particular, on a yo-yo diet since I was 10. I was on and off diets. But I really found that my body did well when I had less carbohydrates. And so then I noticed that I dropped some weight, was starting to like, you know, my leaned out body. So I really stopped eating carbs. And so I went more or less keto. But the problem was, is that as soon as I got a hold of something, you know, not even carb related, like macadamia nuts, for example, I would eat a whole bag. Like a Trader Joe's normal bag, I would eat the whole bag in one sitting because I just could not stop. And it's gone on. You know, I used to be able to control it better. And now really, I can't stop. And just this last past weekend was Thanksgiving. I guess appropriate timing for us to bring out this podcast. you know, I chose not to do Thanksgiving because I was too afraid of what would happen if I had the mashed potatoes and the sweet potatoes and all the leftovers at the house, because I actually have realized that at this point, if I get crackers or I get a bag of chips, I will eat pretty much, if not all, the whole bag in one sitting. And I know a lot of people will do this and they'll be like, oh, well, I'm just, you know, I'm binging a day because, you know, it's a cheat day or whatever. And I have a lot of patients that say that to me, but I can't imagine that you feel good after it. And I'll be honest, I don't feel good after it. I feel extremely stuffed and awful. And then the shame comes. And then it's like this whole roller coaster. And I think the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I think that a lot of us don't really realize that going on a keto diet or going on a paleo diet, and if you stick with it long enough and then you allow yourself to have something, you create a monster in some cases. And like you said, 1 out of 4 people, I mean, 25%. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. It happened to me. Happened to me, folks. Here it is.
And I do want to commend you for being so courageous to talk about your experience, particularly in this format, because I'll just say, I think that is another thing that happens with eating disorders in general is people are hesitant to come forward. People are hesitant to talk about what they're experiencing, whether because they feel alone, they feel like, you know, it's something that they're ashamed of, something that's a secret, you know, and it is something that people experience. And it's really, while it is a mental health condition, it is really no different than a physical health condition that shows up for people. And it doesn't mean anything about the individual that's struggling or, you know, say anything about who they are as a person. It's just something that they're experiencing that we can evaluate, learn from, and make changes so they can live more freely in their lives. I think in regards to that too, you know, when particularly something like keto or, you know, the Atkins diet back in the day, you know, when we do eliminate carbohydrates, there's a few things that happen within our bodies that really aren't actually helpful. Like our bodies are essentially using themselves as fuel because we're not giving them that critical fuel source. But like you said, I think that idea of as soon as I introduce that food to, you know, my system, I just want more. It just feels like I can't stop myself. And part of that is an absolutely natural biological response that's happening, which is one of the reasons why in treatment, we actually talk a lot about exposing ourselves to those foods, habituating those foods, eating those foods with more regularity so your body can trust that you're going to get those foods, you know, when you want them, and then you're able to eat according to hunger and fullness instead of that opportunistic eating that can show up once we've eliminated a particular food group. I think also along with that is that element you said, I'm avoiding Thanksgiving, you know, because of my fear of eating those foods or having those foods, or people are going to tell me that I should eat those foods, whatever it is. You know, that is one of the things that we run into with our patients and clients is, you know, the frequency of avoiding something due to fear of being seen eating or fear of food exposure, you know, and that's where we start to get into this relationship with food is causing impairment in my life.
Yeah, I definitely know that I made some relatives annoyed this holiday season. I mean, my husband and I did go out to eat. I figured if we went to a restaurant, then, you know, we wouldn't have leftovers. It would be better and we would still, you know, have our Thanksgiving. But at the same respect, you know, I look at it and I look at Thanksgivings past and holidays past. I have for at least a few years snuck food and ate food like in the bathroom and done really, really awful things because I didn't want people to see that I wanted more of, say, a pie or I wanted more crackers. I mean, I'm constantly looking back at that, you know, and that's why I was like, if I don't have it around, you know, I can avoid that situation. And I just wonder how many other people out there, and hopefully, you know, my patients will forgive me for, you know, not causing any issues with them. But I do wonder in terms of folks, how many people are struggling where they're hiding the food or they wait. Like, for example, sometimes I wouldn't eat dinner with my husband. I would eat earlier at work so he didn't have to see how much I ate. I mean, it's awful.
Right.
What's happening?
And it does probably feel very isolative and, you know, like you might be the only one dealing with this. And, you know, talking with clients and patients, you know, that's certainly not an isolated experience. And it's certainly not something that you alone have dealt with. Like that is not uncommon at all for individuals to experience. Like I said, people kind of, when they are predisposed to dealing with an eating disorder or they have that brain functionality and structure that makes them more likely to have an eating disorder, they do kind of go one of two ways. And that is more in that binge eating direction of I'm hiding food, eating in secret, you know, eating foods that I feel like I quote unquote shouldn't eat, or they become very rigid and rule bound and very restrictive. And those restrictions tend to generalize to include more and more food for fear of eating too much. I will say too, this is a little bit off topic, but you've said a couple of times, I hope I haven't caused this in my patients or I haven't said something that would activate an eating disorder. And I do want to highlight that no one person or no one event can cause an eating disorder for somebody. Eating disorders really are a complex interplay of our biology and genetics, our psychology and predisposition, and then our environment and the social environment that we've been raised in. And so, you know, for an individual such as one of your patients, maybe a recommendation was made to go on an elimination diet. You know, without a variety of different factors already having been present for those people, you know, that may or may not be a risky thing to do. But I do want to just highlight that no one person or one event can cause an eating disorder for somebody. And that's true of parents too. For any parents that are listening, I think parents can sometimes feel like, oh geez, I caused an eating disorder in my child. You know, I'm a terrible parent or whatever. And it's like, no, parents don't cause eating disorders either. There's a interplay of variables that come into the complex picture. And I think it's just something for us to be aware of and to highlight so that you aren't feeling, you know, super responsible if, you know, a comment was made or a recommendation was made, because there are a host of different things that can contribute to the development of an eating disorder.
That's good to know. I appreciate hearing that. I think a lot of, you know, parents too will appreciate that as well. I think, you know, in that being said, I think one of the big things that I wanted to ask you about is if someone's contemplating, you know, carrying out a autoimmune type of paleo restrictive diet or a food allergy panel or something, you know, kind of based diet based on their results, what would be some questions that you would want folks to ask themselves or even a medical practitioner to think about in terms of warning signs prior to putting someone on one of these diets or prior to putting yourself on one of these diets? What would be the warning signs where this might not be the best mode of action?
Ooh, that is a great question. And, you know, I think it's a big answer, because right. I think we have, you know, the screening component, screening for vulnerabilities. What is the likelihood that this person is at risk of developing an eating disorder? And when we're looking at screening for vulnerabilities, both in the therapeutic world or in the physical health world, you know, we are looking at a multitude of variables, from particular behaviors that an individual, you know, engages in. Maybe they have perfectionistic tendencies. Maybe they have, you know, some impulse control challenges. Maybe they have a tendency to avoid emotions. You know, all of those things are vulnerabilities, you know, but it takes a lengthy conversation to screen for some of these. There's also trait vulnerabilities, and then there's, you know, the genetic vulnerabilities. So that would probably be the easiest for a medical practitioner to be evaluating, are the historical and genetic vulnerabilities. So any presence of substance dependence or behavioral addictions within the family can sometimes be a precursor or something that makes an individual vulnerable. Existing mental health diagnoses, in particular anxiety or depression, about 50% of people with anorexia and bulimia do have a comorbid mood disorder such as anxiety or depression. People with sensory processing difficulties can be more prone to develop eating disorders as well. And then we're looking at history of things as well. Like, did this person ever experience bullying? Did they go through puberty at an earlier age? Do they have a history of dieting? So there's a host of reasons. So this is not a simple answer, and I apologize for that. But I do think, as far as what to continue looking for and continuing to monitor over time, you know, is evaluating the level of preoccupation that this new eating plan has created, or what's the degree of preoccupation, how much impairment is there, what is the level of rigidity with regards to food. I like to encourage people to think about their eating as far as the difference between preference and rule. So it might be a preference that somebody, you know, only eat Himalayan pink salt, for example. I prefer to use Himalayan pink salt in my food. But is it a rule? Can you eat food with table salt in it? You know, so differentiating between what somebody's preference is, and I do this for these reasons, versus I cannot possibly do that without having a pretty activated emotional response. Then we're starting to look at potentially some problems. And then, you know, finding out whether or not, you know, a person's symptom use, you know, specific symptoms, binge eating, restricted eating, or purging behaviors are present, and what are the frequency of those? It's a big answer for a big question.
It's good because I think it's just the fact of just getting people to think a little bit more about their relationship with food, because I for so long have been, I mean, I've been hyper focused on food since I was probably 10, maybe sooner, probably a little sooner, even though 10 is what I can remember. But I've been hyper-focused on food and to the point where my family's made fun of me about my quirks and whatnot. And so I think a lot of people, you know, that have yo-yo dieted or that have been hyper-focused about being healthy really do really do have some background eating disorders. I mean, I work with a lot of folks who are former, I guess you could just basically call it the fitness athletes. So where they drop all the weight, you know, chicken and broccoli, and they're eating that for days on end until they get to their ideal, you know, ripped weight. And then when people come off of that, I feel like there's also a huge binge factor because of all of that restriction too. And now it's starting to really hit me that a lot of these folks probably unearthed a eating disorder, because I have a couple of folks in my practice who went from their goal weight at this competition of being, you know, looking amazing, et cetera, in their minds, and now ballooned up to, you know, twice what they were weighing at that time. And they're wondering what happened? Did my metabolism fail me? And, you know, do I need thyroid meds? It usually is the two questions.
Right.
I get. And I wonder in these cases, if I interviewed a little bit better on the background, like what all the different things you just talked about, if perhaps I would be finding some issues with eating disorders now that were
right. Right.
And
yes. And I appreciate that you did bring up the quizzes, you know, say on the Emily Program's website, or, you know, there's a lot of tests and measures that, you know, people can complete. And even with your own intake paperwork, you could include some of those tests and measures, because I think it is necessary to be able to ask some of those somewhat direct questions about, you know, do you sometimes feel like you've lost control over how much you eat or when you eat? Do food or thoughts about food dominate your life? You know, like, to what degree is this, you know, has this become a preoccupation? So many of our clients that we ask, you know, what percentage of the day are you thinking about food, weight, shape, body size? You know, and for most of our clients, that is 60%+ of the time. It is causing a pretty significant preoccupation for them. And what we aim for is, you know, really helping somebody establish a peaceful relationship with food, a relationship with food that they feel comfortable eating a wide variety. They don't feel threatened going out to eat with friends, or, you know, going to a wedding where there's going to be a buffet of food available. You know, it is just a general part of their day that can be an enjoyable part of their day, but it isn't something that's causing that extreme preoccupation. And I think I wish there were warning labels on some of the things that we do in our younger years, perhaps, like in the fitness industry, fitness competitions. You know, there's a high likelihood of people restricting their intake or getting overly focused on their weight or their body fat percentage. And I wish there were warning labels that said, you know, warning, engaging in this behavior can lead to, you know, some critical concerns that, truth be told, about eating disorders can be fatal. You know, likewise, I wish boys that were involved in wrestling, which is a sport that has a higher incidence of eating disorders, you know, warning, this could cause, you know, some critical conditions that you want to monitor over time. I talk to high school boys that, you know, to make their weight class, they're, you know, going to extreme measures to try and drop weight the day of, you know, a wrestling match or whatever. And some of them are able to go into off season and just go back to normal eating and it's no problem. But some of them have, you know, some significant problem reintroducing a wide variety of foods because of the rigidity during season. So I wish we had warning labels on all of these things, because I don't know that people are aware of how critical it can become.
Oh, I absolutely, hands down, wish that there were, for sure. For sure. Because that's where a lot of my folks in my realm right now, just because I work with a lot of different athletes, I think that's a big problem. A big, big problem. I don't know how many times a day someone comes in and, you know, whether it's, I need to eat vegan, I need to, you know, I need to steam my broccoli and cauliflower plan. Can you tell me how to do that? I mean, it's just
right.
Cringe factor all day long.
Right. And I think that is something that, you know, I've also, you know, I've had clients that have, you know, changed up their eating pattern, or say they, you know, I'm thinking about going vegetarian. Okay. You know, if that's what you're doing, here's what we are going to monitor over time. Mm-hmm. You know, what is that level of preoccupation? Is the rigidity or the, you know, restriction of food starting to generalize and you're eliminating more foods than you previously were? How much freedom do you feel in your life to just participate normally and naturally with friends, with family members, you know, in order to, you know, just actively engage with others? How much fear are you experiencing of food? You know, we're going to monitor how how big of a deal this is becoming in your life, because it can become problematic, you know. And I think being able to, you know, just let patients know, like, let's keep monitoring this. Like, how much freedom are you feeling with food? How much impairment is this causing in your life? Are you finding that you're preoccupied with thoughts about food, weight, shape, you know, any of those things? Because those can all be indicators that additional support might be needed, or a change in protocol, or a change in the original plan might be necessary.
That's huge. And I hope everyone who's out there is listening to that, in terms of just some background for you to be thinking about this and have it on your radar. So one of the big things that I struggled with, of course, too, here in Washington, is finding, you know, a support for my patients. And I found you guys, and you guys are in Washington, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Minnesota, correct?
Correct.
All right. And now, if someone is not in Minnesota, Ohio, Pennsylvania, or Washington, what would you suggest? Is there like a central organization or website where there's lists of programs by state that someone might be looking for?
There are. So I will definitely give you that information. And I will say that if a person's symptom use or the eating disorder that they're dealing with is critical enough that they may need residential care, you know, anybody is able to access our residential services from, you know, come to residential from out of state. Also, many of our facilities have lodging centers. And so in our Seattle office, for example, somebody might be participating in a higher level of care, and they can stay in the lodging that's available in Seattle for a minimal cost, you know, and access Emily program services. So I think just because somebody is out of state, they don't need to rule out the opportunity for services at the Emily program. And that being said, you know, there are treatment centers, you know, across the nation that are available. And, you know, there's outpatient providers in local communities. There's also treatment facilities. So looking into treatment facilities that are available, somebody could go to National Eating Disorder Association website. And that website is just nationaleatingdisorder.org. And they have availability of, you know, referral sources. You can plug in your state and it will give you all of the locals. They also have a 1-800 helpline that you can call and get more information about, you know, resources or treatment providers. And then Eating Disorder Referral and Information Center, which is edreferral.com, also has a host of information about where services are available.
Okay, excellent. So I always like to give people action steps at the end of my podcast, whether I'm giving them guides or whether I'm, you know, spewing off some supplements or whatever it may be. If you had three top things, and it's okay if you have more, but three is usually where I tend to put that magical number. Brian, my little puppy's talking about things. if we have three things that you would like everybody and anybody to know about eating disorder so that they can get themselves the help that they need, what would those three things be?
Ooh, that is a good question. I think I would primarily want people to remember that eating disorders can impact, you know, really anyone, and just to be conscientious of your own relationship with food and, you know, to what degree that relationship feels problematic. I think that's just the step one, you know, becoming aware of your relationship with food and not minimizing potential concerns that are present. I think, let's see, I want steps versus information. I think steps, if you are concerned about yourself or someone you care about, you know, getting more information, I think, is really important. I think those quizzes that you mentioned, Janine, are really helpful at the Emily Program site. There's lots of, you know, quizzes online, but that's just the fastest route, is go to the Emily Program. There's a number of quizzes that you can take, both for yourself, you can take it for a loved one that you're concerned about, and then having that conversation with a loved one can be important, and then seeking help in whatever form that might be, whether that's, you know, a support group, doing a comprehensive assessment at the end of which, you know, if there's a diagnosis, that's relevant, but there will definitely be recommendations. So I think not being afraid of what might be happening, because eating disorders are absolutely treatable and full recovery is possible.
That's awesome. Yes, that's what I like to hear. Full recovery is possible.
Absolutely.
That's way better than any diet you could put yourself on over and over again. As I am 40 this year, I'm going, I have 30 years of dealing with it. And so for those of you out there that have put yourself through hell for this many years with being over obsessed with food, you owe it to yourself to look into getting some help for a final solution instead of just struggling and struggling and struggling.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm going to be doing, folks. And I will tell you all about it, of course, in the podcast to come as how things go. Well, Stacey, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm leaving you with 1 minute to run to your patient. So I apologize, but thank you
everybody
for listening. And Stacey, thank you. We will definitely be talking again as I go through my progress with the Emily Program. And I'm going to share it with everybody on the podcast so y'all can hear about it too.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciated it.
Hey there, health junkies. Phew, we had to end that one quick because Stacey had to get over to seeing some patients. But what I did want to say, just to sum up this podcast, is if you or someone you know is suffering with an eating disorder, or you even suspect that they might have an eating disorder, head over to the website emilyprogram.com and take the quiz. And see how many of those questions you can answer yes to. When I did it, I found that I answered yes to 5 out of 6 questions. And there's only 6 questions. So it was pretty clear to me that, wow, what I had been putting off for years and years as not being able to control my sweet desire for snacks and crackers and cookies really is a problem, and that my restrictive behavior of avoiding certain foods, yes, because there are certain foods that bother me, actually led into more severe issues with my eating and binging in particular. I know I've talked about it on the podcast before about why I'm overweight and my stress eating habits. And now I'm at a point where I've realized I don't have control anymore over my stress eating, and I lose control when I get something that I haven't had in a long time, such as crackers or bread or cookies, and I'm done with it. It's been 30 years of ups and downs and restricting foods, and I'm freaking done with it. So if you know anyone out there or you're struggling yourself, don't wait 30 years to deal with it. Head on over to emilyprogram.com and get some information. If the Emily program is not in your immediate area, like Stacy said, it might be possible for you to still get care from them. Otherwise, using the resources that she mentioned earlier in the podcast, that would be extremely helpful for you to search out some folks in your area. And those resources are nationaleatingdisorder.org and edreferral.com. I will put those in my podcast notes at drjkrausnd.com. I will also put a link to the Emily program as well at drjkrausnd.com. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Take care of yourself. Take care of your friends. Help them out if you think that there is an eating disorder lingering. All right, folks, you've survived another episode of The Health Fix. I'm your host, Dr. Janine Krause. Have a great day, whatever you're doing. Hey everybody, Dr. Janine Krause here. If you liked what you heard today, then head over to drjkrausnd.com to find my free resources and information to know when I post something new that's juicy that you might want to check out. Plus, head over to where you get your podcasts and like, subscribe, and write a review to help get the word out about me and help others at the same time to find me. It really does help, and I really appreciate all of your reviews.